The Dory Monson Show on Cairo Radio. This is The Big Lead.
David Bowes in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. Welcome back to The Big Show. It's always an honor to be here for Dory Monson and the best show in radio. It is it's a crazy thing. We live in a crazy world. We're in a crazy year, and it just keeps getting more bizarre and stranger by the day. And it makes you wonder, will it get better next year? I mean, now the elections are going to be over. In theory, we'll have some kind of grip on the pandemic. But I have my doubts. And it brings me to the first big lead.
The big lead. Top story.
Top story is, with all the polls, if you go to Real Clear Politics and you look at the polls in the presidential race, basically all of them show Joe Biden in a fairly convincing lead, bigger than Hillary Clinton's lead was when she blew it in 2016. And he's been ahead longer than she has for a sustained amount of time. And so it seems to be that 2020 is different from 2016. That the ability for the Trump campaign to win is all but closed. And if you talk with people that hate President Trump, they're convinced that there can be no other scenario, that, you know, the 14% or 20% chance that Trump is given to win this election, depending on where you're looking, is just, you know, it's just that. It's like, oh, well, sure, he has a chance, but what are the odds if there is a disaster or something along those lines? And so you talk to them and they think it just cannot be. There's no way that Biden loses this. Look at the polls. They say it all. You talk to the Trump camp and people with faith in President Trump say, how could they possibly lose to Biden? You know, Biden's been a joke since the 1980s. He is nobody's first choice. He has he doesn't inspire anyone. And he is a gaffe-prone machine with false memories, no memory, and some pretty significant scandals surrounding him that he's managed to slide away from so far. But surely people will see through that. And they know that the economy was going great with Trump. The Democrats say, well, you know, Trump's lost us a bunch of jobs, but everybody knows that's just COVID. And when this thing is over, they're not going to want to return to Biden policy. So there's just no way that Biden's going to win. So I don't fall into either of those camps. I don't think that it's inevitable that one side or the other wins. And I don't generally see the landslide of polls showing that Biden's going to win and say to myself, well, I think Trump will win. You know, I generally think polls indicate at least something. That doesn't mean that there's no potential for flaw. But what National Review has an interview, and the interview from Rich Lowry points to, is that for those who think that the Trump defeat is inevitable and that this one polling firm from the Trafalgar Group is just an outlier, the piece here describing why that polling company has Trump ahead and the methodology that they use to place him ahead is really fascinating. It's worth reading because, let's face it, this year has been so emotionally charged. We could have people just freaking out with either side, you know, on either side if somebody wins. So it's nice to inform yourself to say, okay, this is possible and here's how it would come down. Now, if you're just rolling with the polling averages, this is not for you. But what Rich Lowry shares is that Trafalgar was very successful in 2016. They had Trump leading in Michigan and Pennsylvania. They had Ron DeSantis winning his gubernatorial race. They departed from virtually everybody else in these campaigns, and they were right. Everybody else was wrong. So Lowry checks in with Robert Cahalli, who is predicting a Trump victory in this election. This is the guy who got this Trafalgar polling firm going and who was right in 2016 and these other elections, more so than the rest of the polling firms. And he said, basically, in this interview, hey, we looked at the way things were being polled. We decided it was that they were failing to account for human psychology in these different areas, and therefore oversampling some people, not sampling enough for others. We applied these. We took that into account in our own polling system, and you know, voila, we're more accurate than everybody else. And so he says that a respondent can give you, quote, an answer that's designed to make the person asking the question be less judgmental of the person who answers it. In other words, when you're answering a poll, you don't want the person on the other end of the line to judge you. So you'll answer a certain way that could obscure what your real view is. And so he said, you know, what my firm does, we try to get past that, you know, what you want to say in public to what you really feel, because how you feel is going to drive what your actual ballot says. And so he also differs with number of questions on surveys. I took a survey recently. I've taken three surveys recently where people said, hey, I've just got a minute. I've got a few questions for you. And they start asking, and it takes about 22 to 28 minutes to answer them. Now, I was doing it while I was changing diapers and playing with the kids. I didn't care how loud it was or whatever else. And I just wanted to see what the questions were. Most people are never going to do that. And this guy's right. He says, I don't believe in long questionnaires. I think when you're calling up mom or dad on a school night and they're trying to get the kids dinner into bed and that phone rings and they're supposed to answer 25 to 30 questions, it's not going to happen. So you end up disproportionately, if you go that route, talking to people who love to talk about politics, who skew toward the very, very conservative or the very, very liberal. And the kind of people that win elections are in the middle. So we're missing out there. So instead of asking 25 questions, he keeps his polling between 7 and 9 questions. And he also doesn't like to do all live calls because people don't want to be judged. So he likes to make it possible for them to respond anonymously as much as possible. So they use this collection of live calls, auto calls, text, emails, and others in order to get the results. Then he says something that I think is also true. And that is conservatives are less likely to participate in polls in general. You know, I only have anecdotal evidence there, but when I meet people on the left, they tend to get excited by polls. People on the right tend to think polls are out to get them and they have no interest in answering them. You know, it's like hang up or give false information. I even confess on one of the surveys I took, I answered a question. I can't remember which one. But I specifically answered it in a way that would throw off the scent, so to speak. And because I thought, oh, I know what you want me to say, and I'm not going to say it. So then they say we have a 5-to-1 refusal rate among conservatives. You have to work very hard to get a fair representation of conservatives when you do any kind of survey. And so if people don't account for that, they're going to have a survey that skews the wrong way. And so he builds his list accordingly. And he goes out of his way to try to make up for all of these things. They include low propensity voters, knowing that other pollsters don't reach out to those people. They say pollsters who use exit polls from previous election to determine the demographics are wrong because, you know, a lot of people have changed over the course of 4 years. It's a knowable number. Every state maintains those statistics. So it's bogus to use the old data. He doesn't use small sample sizes. You know, a lot of polls use 400, 500, 600 people for a state. He uses at least 1,000. He says he avoids so-called waiting to get the partisan mix of respondents right. You know, they might want 35% of Republicans, but they come up short because they're less likely to respond. You know, so they wait those answers. So the few who did respond get their answers to count more. And he says, no, we don't do that. We just wait until we get the actual sample. And he also points out that Republicans who don't like Trump are eager to answer polls. Republicans who do like Trump are not eager to answer polls. So among that 22%, you get an extra weight that goes against Trump. And so he says the presidency is won state by state, not on the basis of a national vote. So because of all these methodological difficulties, and by the way, we see that all the time. So Biden, you know, widely ahead. I've seen it more responsibly covered this year than most years, but there have been a number of surveys saying, you know, Biden 10-point lead nationwide. Well, in California and Washington State and Oregon, for example, you know, Trump could lose 100% of the vote and he could still win the presidency. So, you know, the fact that we're a federal system that all the states count in the Electoral College to determine who the president is, you know, we're not a strict direct democracy, which I think is a good thing. because I think states do count and state interests count, and it helps remind whoever's running that they have to run a campaign for the whole nation, not California, Texas, New York, Illinois, Florida, and Pennsylvania. But there's more to it than that. So when it comes to the 2020 race, with all these polls showing, you know, Trump's going to lose, this guy has Trump in the lead. He thinks Trump could win North Carolina, Georgia, Florida, Arizona, Michigan, or Pennsylvania, and Ohio. And then he says he thinks Trump will win North Carolina and Florida. Doesn't think Biden wins in Georgia. And then in Arizona, he thinks Trump will take that and make up, you know, have to make up some ground. And then he says he's gaining in Pennsylvania. And then he thinks the undecided will break toward Trump in Pennsylvania and that he'll win Michigan. So his best guess is an Electoral College victory in the high 270s to the low 280s. So, you know, again, that's a pretty slender margin of error, pretty slender victory. But if it breaks the way that this guy's saying, and this is the number one story in political news right now, this interview, and part of that might be due to hope, because they're the people who love Trump, they see all these polls, they're depressed about it, and they're saying, you know, geez, I hate reading things that don't go my way. And so they're reading this and saying, well, you know, this is how it is, of course. And it wouldn't take much, because he's not saying it's a sure thing. He's saying, I think it'll break this way. It all depends. You know, and again, this is a challenge because we're in early voting right now. So you wonder, you know, with 20 million people so far early voting, how many of, you know, how many people have a chance to break one way or the other? You know, what happened at the moment they decided to cast their ballot that would change them for or against Biden or Trump? And with Biden and Trump, with Biden, you know, his kid gets $50,000 a month for seemingly no advice whatsoever from an energy company. He's got connections to Chinese companies that are showering him with money. And the Biden campaign and much of the news media want us to pretend that there's no connection to Joe Biden over that. That makes no sense whatsoever. It doesn't pass the smell test. But numerous politicians have gotten away with such things, and it doesn't stop them from getting elected. Trump has his own problems. His biggest isn't any particular scandal. It's his inability to stay quiet when someone insults him and not go to Twitter to have a word vomit session. And he seems to be engaged in that right now, which brings us to the next big lead.
The big lead, top national.
Trump versus Dr. Fauci, America's doctor, and by appointment. Dr. Fauci was on 60 Minutes, and he expressed no surprise whatsoever that the president ended up with COVID-19.
Were you surprised that President Trump got sick?
Absolutely not. I was worried that he was going to get sick when I saw him in a completely precarious situation of crowded, no separation between people, and almost nobody wearing a mask. When I saw that on TV, I said, oh my goodness, nothing good can come out of that. That's got to be a problem. And then sure enough, it turned out to be a super spreader event.
So it was outside. I don't like the term super spreader, because I feel like, you know, it's a little inflammatory and hyperbole, but still, you know, it spread, the virus spread there. And I don't know what event it was that got some of the Harris staff on the Biden side of things infected. But, you know, when people get together, they're going to have to measure risk, and they're going to have to get together from time to time. And so Trump hears this, the Trump people hear this, and once again, Donald Trump does not like being questioned in any way, shape, or form. This is no surprise. Remember, this is the guy who said he's never done anything where he had to apologize to God for. So he's interpreted as he will, but it's described as going after Fauci. I think it's less of that and more of the usual. I mean, he doesn't strike me as particularly annoyed, but it's certainly enough to make headlines that probably won't help him in the current election. Listen.
Every time he goes on television, there's always a bomb, but there's a bigger bomb if you fire him.
So he basically says, you know, the doctor, he's always got, he's woe is me, hand worrying, you know, the virus is there, Virus is that. And then he says everybody's kind of sick of hearing about the virus.
People are tired of COVID. People are saying, whatever, just leave us alone. Every time he goes on television, there's always a bomb.
Yeah. So, you know, he's right about that to a certain extent. I think people are tired. There is a fatigue. I think more and more health departments are recognizing that fatigue. I also think that there are people who look to Trump and Fauci and yeah, they look to Trump and Fauci and they're ready to, you know, place the blame on Trump no matter what. So the guy, you know, he could have caught COVID-19, you know, on a fluke walking by somebody and they would have blamed whatever. I mean, I've seen people try to blame the worldwide death total on Trump or the U.S. death total on Trump. There's a number of factors that account for why we have higher deaths than other people. And also, if you look at the spread in Europe and other parts of the world, they're catching up to us in terms of the per capita number of people getting infected. So I think it's relatively ridiculous to place all blame on Trump. And I also think that it's, you know, I mean, there's been a bit of this from everybody, but it's a pandemic. It's a virus. It doesn't have a political party. And the notion that you can just point to Trump and say it's all his fault, these 200,000 people died, it's unseemly, ridiculous, a politicalization of this disease. And I think long term, it's not helpful for us. So I think we have one more cut of Trump on Fauci.
We have to update, but it's actually he's talking about Biden here.
Oh, we're missing one of the Fauci ones I was thinking of, but that's okay.
No,
so then Trump, no?
No, I don't have another Fauci cut.
Okay, go ahead. Just play the one where he's going after Biden then.
His strategy seems to be to call Biden a criminal. Why is that?
He is a criminal. He's a criminal. He got caught. Read his laptop. And you know who's a criminal? You're a criminal for not reporting it. You are a criminal for not reporting it. Let me tell you something. Joe Biden is a criminal, and he's been a criminal. You're a criminal in the media for not reporting it.
Speaking of hyperbole, you know, look, I do think it's weird and objectionable that the media is not that interested in this when they were fascinated for 2 years with the Russian dossier from the foreign agent that was hired by the Hillary Clinton campaign. You know, I mean, turnabout's, you know, fair play here. And Trump's pointing out, hey, now you've got media kind of celebrating the squelching of this material on Facebook and Twitter. I find that to be deeply disturbing. And there's enough there that we know of that's verified, not of these exact emails, but of the finances of Hunter Biden to, you know, to signify that there's something suspicious going on. So I'm a bit empathetic to Trump, although he is the way he speaks on his own behalf is not always conducive toward convincing the undecideds, maybe that, you know, that a new era is upon us. David Bowes in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. David Bowes in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. Welcome back to the big show. WNBA players are upset because the WNBA is not as popular as some other sports. Seattle Storm's point guard, the legendary Sue Bird, said, quote, "It's 70 to 80% black women, a lot of gay women. We're tall, we're big, and I think there's just maybe this intimidation factor with that. People are quick to talk about it, judge it, put it down. And soccer, you just don't see that just based on how they look," she said. This response came after CNN asked her about her girlfriend and soccer star Megan Rapinoe's comments that the female soccer league draws viewers because, quote, "most girls are white girls next door," unquote. Bird went on, or Rapinoe said, quote, "Where's that same energy for the best women's basketball players on the planet? Where's that energy for the women's sports that instead of scanning cute and white and straight are scanned tall and black and queer?" she asked. So they're convinced it's a societal thing, you know, until society sees people different, You know, she says, with basketball players, we're all shapes and sizes. The problem isn't marketing. It's how the world, how society and the outside world looks at people. You know, I think that there's probably a degree of truth there that you've got, you know, you've got different people that are going to appeal, you know, to broader or more segmented populations. But these are the challenges that everybody, I mean, look, some politicians, they shoot to the top of the heap because they've got the best hair. They got the good look. Television anchors, you know, you don't see a whole host of ugly television anchors. You know, you have people that where beauty or certain looks can help you achieve in certain ways. I think that for women's basketball, I think the big thing is the comparison. It seems to me that there's this constant comparison of women's basketball to men's basketball. And you know, like even here, it's like, where's this energy? What about, you know, men's basketball so popular? What about women's basketball? And it's because we're different. It's because this or that. I also think to a certain degree, you have to recognize that women's basketball is different from men's basketball, and it's not at the same speed as men's basketball. You know, I think you could have, you could prove that given, you know, enough observation and examination of film and other things. That doesn't mean it's not worthwhile. It doesn't mean that people don't love it. It just means that it's different from men's basketball, and, you know, and speed counts in a sport. There's part of the thrill that, you know, that comes with it. So I think, you know, part of the thing is I always associate women's basketball with kind of politics and cause rather than just it being the sport. You know, it reminds me of when people, not institutions, but people, the point they're constantly comparing themselves or other people to others, that person's not going to measure up. You have to take it for what it is and make it the best it can be. It seems like, you know, that's what should happen with women's basketball here is instead of thinking, oh my gosh, this is horrible that we're not, you know, we're not liked or beloved the same as others, just keep pushing out the best product you can and see what happens. You know, over time, audiences grow or they collapse based on interest. But it's happened with all kinds of different sports and products and people and everything else. I mean, that's just the nature of the world. So, you know, again, if you're trying to divide things by, you know, what's happening here, it's, you know, color, sexuality and other things, then, you know, to me, people go to sports for an escape. They want to get away from that. So it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy in a way. And at the same time, you know, you take a look at men's basketball, look at the speed going on, look at why it's so popular, and just, you know, there's kind of a sour grapes thing. You look at it and you say, why can't you just be happy for them and then focus on this other thing? You know, let it go. In other words, move on. So, you know, again, Sue Bird's, you know, been a legend forever. If you look at the claim here is that soccer is not popular because, you know, it's the cute girls next door, and basketball is not popular because it's, you know, tall, black and gay. Well, I mean, the soccer players aren't tall, but for crying out loud, I mean, the most outspoken soccer player is clearly identified as gay. So, and she's world famous and adorned the headlines of papers everywhere. I don't think that's, you know, diminished her appeal. You know, and that is also true of a number of different sports, number of different players, you know, et cetera. So, you know, again, it's. You know, the WNBA, I remember we used to get tickets to the WNBA. You know, people would say, hey, you want some free tickets? And it reminded me of the Mariners early on. And the Mariners, when I was a kid, you could get free tickets and they'd give you, you know, 10 tickets or 14 tickets or whatever that you didn't need. WNBA was the same way for publicity campaigns. But then, you know, the Mariners caught on. People, you know, started getting used to basketball. And, you know, the WNBA will be the same thing. It's either going to catch or it won't catch. You know, but there are some things in society that you're not going to change. You're not going to change over time. You're not going to, you've got to make the appeal on the sport, not the other social, you know, the social dynamics and other stuff around it. Just say, hey, look, this is the best women's basketball that we've got. This is the best women's basketball in the world. And here's what you're missing. And the more you can show people that they're missing something, the more people that will ultimately tune in. You know, the more you whine about it and you think that people should, you know, should have to tune in because otherwise it's evident that they're not enjoying the visuals as much, then it just, I think it just makes people think, well, I already watched CNN. You know, I already watched MSNBC. I was tuning into sports to see people play, you know. And by the way, the NFL and NBA are steeped in a lot of politics right now, too. And I, you know, I think over the long term, I think that harms their sport. You know, not that you can't use your fame and your platform to advocate. I think that's valid. That works. And I think that's laudable in many ways. But I think when you're doing it on the field, when the sports teams, you know, start doing that as a part of it, then it becomes, you know, it's different. You don't have the same escape from the world that sports was offering before. It's like when you're watching a movie, you know, and you can always tell you're watching a movie and then all of a sudden a character that has one character arc and you're used to them, they've redefined this character or moved them all the way around in a way that's not consistent with the world that you're watching. And they're doing it to send some kind of a message. Usually it's like an environmental message or a social identity message or something. And it just takes you out of that picture, you know, and people congratulate themselves on sending the message, but they've diminished the product, so to speak, and made it so that, you know, people have lost a little bit of that escapism. So you gotta focus on what it is that you're actually creating. Speaking of which, there's a fascinating story on from Twitter from Christopher Rufo, local filmmaker Christopher Rufo, who has a new scoop out. He says here where he says three Seattle area government agencies are now holding racially segregated diversity training programs. He says he's obtained exclusive whistleblower documents that expose the new policy described as segregation for social justice, or that's how it could be described. The King County prosecutor implemented a new policy requiring employees, this is from Rufo's Twitter account, to sign a, quote, equity and social justice pledge and assigning, quote, continued training for white employees who must accept responsibility for their own racism and question the white power structure. So the white employees have to have continued training. Other employees don't. In Washington State, we're supposed to have a colorblind approach to government. You know, that's, in fact, in general, we're supposed to have a colorblind approach to government so that we don't discriminate. You can't have some kind of white indoctrination policy and training policy and then start with the assumption that they're all racist. And then he goes on with the King County Library System and the Veterans Affairs, and he's calling for an investigation. The guy's doing some solid work there. David Bowes in for Dorian Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. David Bowes in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. Welcome back to the big show, and it's now time for awesome audio. We'll start with Donald Trump is not a fan of the mainstream media, as you know. CNN has been hammering away at Trump, CNN hosts hammering away at Trump, including his irresponsible attitude toward COVID, even from guys like the host Chris Cuomo, who, remember, he went out without a mask when he was diagnosed. He escaped his basement bunker and went on a tour and was upset when people challenged him. Anyway, Trump is irate with much of the media right now for not playing up the Biden laptop scandal, at least taking it as seriously as he thinks they should. And so he's denounced them as, well, I'll let him say it.
With a pandemic. Pandemic. They're getting tired of the pandemic, aren't they? Getting tired of the pandemic. You turn on CNN, that's all they cover. COVID, COVID, pandemic, COVID, COVID, COVID. You know why? They're trying to talk everybody out of voting. People aren't buying it, CNN, you dumb bastards. They're not buying it. That's all they're talking about.
Strange to think that George Washington had a book on manners named, you know, that was, you know, purported to be his list of manners that he advised people to take. I don't think we're going to get that this time around. And when he talks about CNN always wanting to cover something, their chief legal analyst, according to Vice, is in trouble because Tubin exposed himself in a Zoom meeting, allegedly, and is suspended now by what? The New Yorker, and CNN's giving him some personal time. Maybe CNN should think about covering a lot of things these days. Anyway, so Trump versus CNN, you know, Trump, got to hand it to him. He's decided to play it the same way, the whole way. You might have thought that he would try to broaden his base, so to speak, in the second term, what most presidential candidates would try to do. Trump is just staying Trump. Maybe there is no other way. Which brings us to the fact that some people are just crazy deranged when it comes to Trump. Some people just can't handle the idea that Trump could win a second term, and they think that the U.S. has fallen into some kind of dark alternate dimension with Donald Trump. And there's proof, I think, that some people are just going too far. They forget that if they just live their lives, the federal government doesn't necessarily reach every part of them, even though they might think it does if they're following the frenzied 24/7 news cycle and social media. I think that this attitude can now be encapsulated in this single woman's now viral video where she is expressing her increasing concern that people out there are not as aware as she is that Donald Trump needs to be stopped.
Terrified! Listen to me, Republicans! Listen! You are the people in history they warned us about! They warned us about people like you! Pay attention! We're losing our democracy! Wake up! Wake up!
Okay, I think it's safe to say that she needs to chill a little bit. I think she needs to take a break and just think about things other than politics for just a little bit of time. Because clearly things have gotten out of control for her. Can you imagine sitting at the dinner table for her or sitting in an office cubicle and politics comes up? You would just, every part of you would just cringe and you'd shudder to think of it. Anyway, and that brings us to the final piece of awesome audio for the day. And that is from Rush Limbaugh. Love him or hate him, you know, Rush has been iconic when it comes to radio. He single-handedly, I think, saved the AM side of the dial. He brought forward a new, basically, industry of talk radio and popularized it, both, you know, which is why this station, and you could argue that this station exists and other talk stations exist, both on the AM and the FM side of the dial. Limbaugh's been enormously talented. But he's also facing a serious bout with cancer. My wife had the opportunity to get to know Rush and become friends with Rush because she brought him to Afghanistan when she worked for the State Department as a way to educate Limbaugh about what was happening there and also to meet the troops and met the real Rush Limbaugh, not, you know, which is same as the guy on the air, but, you know, got to know him in a personal way. And so it's been tough news that Rush is suffering from cancer. And he had an update today.
I try to remain as committed to the idea what's supposed to happen will happen when it's meant to. I mentioned at the outset of this, the first day I told you that I have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. It is of immense value, strength, confidence. And that's why I'm able to remain fully committed to the idea that what is supposed to happen will happen when it's meant to. There's some comfort in knowing that some things are not in our hands. There's a lot of fear associated with that too, but there is some comfort. It's helpful. God, is it? It's helpful to be able to trust and to believe in a higher plan.
And you know, as anyone, I think anyone facing a cancer, terminal cancer diagnosis can attest to, you look for comfort wherever you can. And God bless you if you're facing anything close to what he is. David Bowe's in for Dory Monson.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. You're really a fantastic audience.